The Senate's to-do list this week includes the next steps on information technology contracting reform and enhancing the role of the chief information officer at federal agencies. But the Senate is playing catch-up. The House has already passed its version of the Federal Information Technology Acquisition Reform Act. Congressman Jerry Connolly, Democrat of the 11th District in Virginia, is a co-sponsor of FITARA. In our congressional spotlight, he tells Federal News Radio's Francis Rose what he likes about the Senate version and what he would like to change.
I think some of the essential reforms that we're concerned about were retained whole and entire in some cases in the House bill. For example, my data center consolidation bill, which became a big chapter in FITARA, is now included in this bill. There are some cloud computing and some management principles that are also in there. They took a different approach to the CIO, so they sort of don't discourage multiple CIOs, but they sort of kind of invest one with more authority than others. The House version, frankly, is cleaner, and from a management point of view, is clearer in terms of who's in charge, who's got the responsibility, where is the accountability, and who gets to make decisions. And I think we need to streamline that in the federal government. We cannot have 250 people with the title CIO stretched out among 24 agencies. That's just a recipe for nobody's in charge and nobody can clearly figure out, you know, the organizational chart. And I think we need to clean that up. So I much prefer the House version, but I am really glad, we shouldn't lose sight of the forest for the trees here. I'm very glad that for the first time, the Senate unanimously passed out their version of FITARA. And I'm very proud of that. And having passed three times on the floor of the House unanimously, I'm very confident we can get some action, either in tacking on the Senate version of our bill as an amendment to a bigger piece of legislation or getting it on the floor as a freestanding bill.
One can understand why you're a little biased toward the House version, being your involvement with it. You must be heartened, though, by the fact that some agencies are already taking the one CIO on themselves and doing it themselves. Commerce is moving in that direction. The General Services Administration's done it. And that seems to be the benefits of it are making themselves obvious enough to agencies that they're doing it without the need for the legislation.
Absolutely. And in many ways, FITARA, among other things, also codifies reforms that have been advocated by the administration. This is not a political or partisan bill, and it's one that I would hope the Obama administration would embrace because I think it's a helpful management tool in providing a statutory framework for doing what they've said they want to do.
That embrace has been a little bit awkward. Steve Van Rockel, the federal chief information officer, did a web chat with my colleague Jason Miller not too long ago. And he said, I don't actually think we need necessarily legislation in this space. I think the increasing pressure on the role that technology is playing is going to take us with good management practices and with good policy in the right direction of where we need to go.
Well, all I can tell you is I have a lot of respect for Steve Van Rockel and his private sector experience, but that doesn't pass the giggle test. How can anyone with a straight face say that after the disastrous website rollout of last fall? Mm-hmm. That almost junked the president's legacy legislation, healthcare reform. That's how serious that failure was. And if we need a more recent reminder, look at what's happening at the IRS. Paper backups? That's how you back up a hard disk on your computer? The fact that we can't retrieve emails because we don't have the technology? The fact that we have obsolete computers? 90,000 employees in the IRS alone. And the average age is at least 7 years. In industry, the standard is 3. They don't have, great backup systems. A lot of them are, save and print.
Mm-hmm. And, to be fair, it's not just the IRS.
That's pervasive
across government.
The latest issue is the IRS, but you're absolutely right. We've got problems across the federal family. So the idea that we don't need some help. And just recently, I asked the head of the IRS, could the cloud help you? The cloud, which our bill obviously is promoting. Mm-hmm. And he said, I don't trust the security with the cloud. The head of an agency with 90,000 employees. Now, contrast that with the CIA, who presumably is concerned about security. They're contracting with a major private sector firm, Amazon Web Services, to in fact go into the cloud. So Here we've got the head of one agency saying, I don't trust it, and the head of another saying, we're embracing it and giving a private sector contract. Now, if Mr. Van Rogel thinks that's just fine, then I would have to respectfully suggest to him he ought to take a look again.
So let's pull back on that for a moment, because I think that's interesting. We have been talking collectively in the federal community for at least 5 years about cloud and security, and the General Services Administration's OCSIT has matured now at this point, the FedRAMP program,
yep,
where there are any number of ways that an agency can get certified cloud solutions for storage or anything as a service at this point. So where do you think that discomfort comes from? I presume you're talking about Mr. Koskinen, who is uncomfortable with cloud technology at this point. Where do you think that comes from? Could that be generational?
I think it is in part generational. I also think it's a natural instinct to protect your assets and not trust outsourcing them to private enterprise. What could go wrong with that?
Mm-hmm.
But what, you know, and I understand that concern, but conversely, well, look at what has gone wrong within your own agency or any agency in terms of, you know, how's that working out for you?
Mm-hmm.
We can save money. We can make it more efficient. We can improve your productivity, we can upgrade your technology, and we can better secure the data by, in fact, going to the cloud.
I want to get to the state of information technology within the IRS specifically, but before we get too far afield from FITARA, what is your sense of the timeline there? Your version went through on the NDAA back in May. Where do you see this going, that it could potentially get to the president's desk?
Our understanding is that our colleagues in the Senate are looking for a vehicle, and hopefully they will find one between now and the November election, and then we're off to the races. So I'm very hopeful that we're finally going to see some real action on our bill. We've been working through two Congresses now to try to get this done. And I think it will make a big difference in providing, as I said, a statutory management framework for managing, better managing IT acquisition and procurement.
Do you take away from Congressman Thornberry's panel in the House Armed Services Committee looking at defense acquisition reform any kind of thoughts about where they're headed separately? It seems like they're kind of headed in a separate direction more broadly from the more broad acquisition reform conversations that you've been leading.
I think they're on a parallel track, and mm-hmm. in many ways the Pentagon is ahead of the game in some respects. And in some other ways, actually, is not getting with the program. So we need to bring them into the fold. I want to respect territorial, you know, boundaries. I find it ironic, though, that the Pentagon and its allies in the Hill want to have a parallel track, not subject technically to the provisions of FITARA. And one of the criticisms of Stephen Rokel that you cited before is that it didn't include the Pentagon. And I think, well, you're at OMB. If you want the Pentagon included, just wave your wand.
What was the nature of the conversations with OMB about FITARA as you were drafting
it? I've had no substantive conversations with OMB and FITARA. We've had a couple of meetings where they have clucked sympathy with our goals and have said they'd get back to us. They have never sat down with us, never, and given us a list of concerns. The private industry did. Colleagues in the Hill did. But OMB has never done that. I suspect that the disease at OMB is not invented here. We don't need no stinking legislation. Thank you very much. And that's really, that's just denial of reality, because every day of the week, you're being reminded of the massive failures throughout the federal family in the management of IT assets. And I want to quote from that your interview that you cited with Jason Miller here and Van Rokel. If you're someone like me who co-wrote a piece of legislation that normally is kind of arcane, Federal Information Technology Acquisition Reform, it's not,
we love it.
We love it, and we know it's important.
Yes.
So here's his quote. If you do approach legislation, the myriad of the influence needs to be thought through, I think, in more of a broad brush, unquote. I would challenge our listeners to divine the meaning of such a sentence. I have no earthly idea what that means. And if that's my guidance from OMB, I think I need to move on.
Well, to be fair, the next statement that he made, just going in and saying CIOs need to have a seat at the table, which is very, very important to me and something I promote through Portfolio Stat, but was the first policy memo issued out of my office during my tenure here, was really centered around CIO authorities, and I feel strongly about it. It sounds to me, that quote to me, he's saying, we support the concepts behind it. We're not sure that legislation in Congress is the vehicle to achieve these issues.
Well, if the legislation only mandated that the CIO has a seat at the table, I might agree with Mr. Benarogal. Read our legislation, Steve. That's not what it does. It actually creates a hierarchy. It singles out a primary CIO, not just a seat at the table, but who's accountable, who's responsible, who has flexible decision-making authority, so that we can make better decisions, including, for example, breaking large acquisition contracts into bite-sized modular pieces so we can better manage them. And when they go awry, we can pull the plug if we have to, just like we do in the private sector. There's no incentive, unfortunately, in the federal government to sort of pull the plug on massive, large IT acquisition projects when they clearly are not working. And as a result, we waste more money instead of cauterizing and stemming our losses. And so I think Mr. Benarogal has mischaracterized and clearly sort of diluted what, in fact, our bill does. And of course, you're at OMB. That the word management's in there. So tell me that at Microsoft, when you were there with Bill Gates, Mr. Benarogal, that you would have welcomed having 250 people with the title CIO. That's how you manage in the private sector, right? Well, why would we manage that way in the public sector? And you're at OMB, the Office of Management and Budget. And so I just find that an extraordinary statement that flies in the face of the reality we're facing, frankly, and we can do a better job. And people want to do a better job in the federal family. So the reluctance at OMB, not the opposition, but the reluctance, I just think is highly misguided. And what's going to happen is Congress is just going to bypass them. They're going to be bystanders. And frankly, at this point, they deserve to be. But don't tell an equal but separate branch of government that it has no role to play in something that is begging for attention. And that is the management of IT assets and acquisitions in the federal government.
Less money for the Internal Revenue Service in fiscal 2015 might mean big cuts in services. New IRS Commissioner John Koskinen warned of potential service problems for people who call IRS helplines and other things that would take longer or just wouldn't happen if the IRS budget declines. But the House of Representatives passed a budget with a big cut for the IRS anyway. Congressman Jerry Connolly is a congressman from the 11th District of Virginia and a member of the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee. They're one of the committees investigating the IRS hard drive crash. In our congressional spotlight, he tells Federal News Radio's Francis Rose why he blames Republicans in the House for broader IT problems at the agency.
They're outraged that a hard drive crashed and that we lacked the technical capacity to retrieve the emails that were contained therein, despite all kinds of attempts to do so. And no evidence whatsoever of a deliberate crash. And they're treating it like a unique event. So a couple of facts. Under the Republican watch, since they've been in the majority, they have slashed the IRS's budget by $850 million. The budget, the appropriations bill they're marking up as we speak, cuts another $350 billion. That is over $1.1 billion. Of cuts to the IRS. I said billion earlier. I meant million. So $1.1 billion will have been cut in 4.5 years. And we're supposed to think there are no consequences from that. So as what happens? Well, there was a story just today in the Washington Post. The backlog of trying to get back to phone inquiries has just grown exponentially. The ability to do audits and field audits and follow up on them grown exponentially. $350 billion left on the table every year of uncollected taxes that are actually owed because of lack of resources to follow up on it by the IRS. How many computers have crashed so far this year? We're supposed to believe Lois Lerner's hard drive is a unique incident. So far this year, and remember we're only in now July, half the year still to go, 3,000 computers out of roughly 80 or 90,000 in the IRS have crashed so far. That means they're on schedule to have about 6,000 crash just this year. It's not an unusual incident. And the ability to, the only backup system they've got is print and save. That's pretty primitive in today's day and era. And this is the system that my friend Steve Van Roekel thinks needs no further legislative tinkering.
You understand how one can look at the IRS email situation, though, and say it looks weird because Ms. Lerner's information was unrecoverable. A number of the others that have been talked about, the information was recovered from those. It looks odd. The circumstance is, I mean, you can explain the numbers, and those numbers as you explain them make sense to somebody like me who looks at the federal government overall. You can understand why somebody from another viewpoint would look at it and say this does look odd.
Yep, absolutely. And I understand that they could be suspicious. But to jump to the conclusion, you have to accept some things that are not true. This is a unique event. It's unique to Lois Lerner. It requires the entire technical staff to assist her in covering up, wink, blink.
Mm-hmm.
And to say nothing of the fact that we're assuming there was content in that computer that she was trying to hide. All the evidence actually shows the opposite, that she went to some length to try to get the technical people to recover whatever they could from her hard drive. There is no evidence to the contrary. And as I said, I wish it were a unique event, but it's not. Within the IRS itself, 6,000 hard drive crashes a year, and many of those are in similar situations to Lois Lerner. You mentioned some where there was the ability to retrieve some of what was lost, but there, for every example like that, there's another one or two where we could not.
Mm-hmm.
And so better managing IT, upgrading their resources, and pumping some resources, some dollar resources, into a cash-starved IRS, I think, is part of the answer.
Is there a way, do you believe, to separate the ideological opposition to the IRS and some of their tactics from the issues that you talked about a moment ago, which is revenue left on the table, uncollected taxes that are fairly due the United States by law, and so on, that you could potentially find an ally on the Republican side and say, listen, we might not agree on some of the issues about the IRS, but we do agree they have a role to play, and we can agree that they should have the resources they need to be able to at least effectively and efficiently do their job.
I think there are members, Republican members on the other side of the aisle, who would agree with that. But not publicly. They're not going to buck the dominant ideology right now. And the IRS is the major boogeyman on their side of the aisle and with their base. So if you want to make yourself an object of derision on the Rush Limbaugh radio show, by all means, as a Republican, you know, try to defend the IRS and talk about the need for the IRS to have more resources. Now, what is so interesting to me is having made the debt, the Uber Alles issue, on that side of the aisle, right? I mean, everything falls before the debt. We need to have sequestration to reduce that debt. Well, if you're leaving $350 billion a year on the table, multiply that times 10, and you're talking just that one source, we're not cutting a dime out of anything, we're not raising anyone's taxes, we're not slashing investments, that's $3.5 trillion over 10 years. No need for sequestration. And that's just one major source of revenue. That's an obvious answer to a debt reduction in a very substantial way, a real key cornerstone in your sort of big deal approach to debt reduction. Why wouldn't you do that unless it's all about ideology and partisan politics? It's not about a sincere commitment to debt reduction because you don't like the IRS. You don't like, frankly, the income tax. You don't like a tax code. And that nihilism, that anarchy that infuses some on the other side of the aisle is proving to have disastrous consequences in the day-to-day functioning of one of the most important federal agencies we have.
We've spoken on the air and off the air about the conversations you've had with Mr. Koskinen. Let's go down a couple of layers inside the IRS, even maybe to your rank and file constituent level. What are you hearing from inside that agency about how all of this has impacted day-to-day operations and the mission of the agency?
I don't have any information about how it affects the day-to-day operations, but I do have feedback I get from my constituents who work at the IRS who are deeply troubled by becoming sort of the punching bag for ideologues on the Hill who simply want to score some cheap points between now and the midterm elections this year. And if heads roll, if reputations are damaged, if productivity's hurt at a major federal agency, well, those are the casualties of war. It's a very amoral approach, I think, to the political arena, and it is something that I consider reckless and deplorable. And in many ways, it is epitomized by how they treated a very successful public servant, John Koskinen. Here's a man who's devoted his life to public service, has been successful both in the private sector and the public sector. You know, you and I both got to know him at something called Y2K, mm-hmm. Where we were worried about a technology collapse. Remember, IT again.
I do.
When that dial hit 12 midnight in the year 2000. And thank God it was a crisis that did not occur. But I will tell you, the preparation going into it actually made this country better prepared for dealing with subsequent crises like 9/11, because we had tested systems. And that was all on John Koskinen's watch. And he did an outstanding job. So, you know, he's retrieved at the age of 74 to come out of retirement to handle one more crisis for the federal government, to try to put it right. And instead of extolling his willingness to serve his country, my Republican colleagues on the Oversight and Government Reform Committee decided to make him a poster child for everything they hate in the IRS and to taint him somehow with manufactured scandals and modest, relatively modest problems, as if he had something to do with it. And it was a really disheartening and, I think, shameful episode in our committee, and it was something very difficult to watch and participate in.
He wasn't there when all this happened.
That's
and,
right.
And that part of it, I believe you're correct. I wonder if it's hard at this point to call it a manufactured scandal. There certainly is something there. One can disagree, as you do, with the way that Chairman Issa and Chairman Camp are going about finding that information. But the appearance certainly is unusual at this point, at the least.
Well, I guess I'm going to stick to my words. What do we know? All that's been proved is, after the Citizens United disastrous ruling by the Supreme Court, the IRS was flooded with applications for tax-exempt status pursuant to the Citizens United ruling. And they, again, being short-staffed and being flooded with this, what to do, how to make decisions. And so they came up with these BOLOs, be on the lookout for, and they were, you know, feckless and politically, you know, tone deaf, but it was out of panic to come up with something. And this was done in the Cincinnati regional office. When it was discovered or revealed to headquarters, including Lois Lerner, they tried to tell them to stop. Don't do that. Don't you want, you know. Now, there's no evidence that this went higher up, which, this back to my word, manufactured crisis, that doesn't comport with the Republican right-wing narrative. They want to have planted in your head that this had the highest level approval. This is akin to the Nixon administration kind of scandal, even though not one scintilla of evidence has been produced that would suggest that at all. No White House involvement. In fact, Republicans at the IRS have so testified. The IG himself, who's a Republican at the IRS, Republican appointee under Bush, hasn't found any evidence of that. But that hasn't stopped Darrell Issa and his acolytes from saying it in the hopes that maybe it will stick. That's manufactured. They're connecting dots that are, you know, those dots exist, but they aren't to be connected. Was it an unfortunate episode in the IRS? Yes. Is Lois Lerner a heroic character? No. But did something really malevolent occur here? Absolutely not.